Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
It's with great pleasure that I welcome you to this 20th anniversary celebration. And I think about 20 years, that makes our organization the longest running reading series of its kind that we've ever had in Chicago. Just very briefly, our purpose is twofold: to provide a forum in a downtown location to which poets and writers of distinction can come and read their work and interact with a live audience, whether they're Nobel laureates or simply writers of talent who ought to be better known. We also work to widen the audience for literature among young people and among underserved populations. Now it's my pleasure to ask one of the best known and surely one of the best loved writers this town has ever produced to come on stage and introduce tonight's guests, the incomparable, the one and only Studs Terkel.
About 12 years ago, when Prairie Home Companion Garrison Keillor first appeared in Chicago in the flesh at the Studebaker Theater, and later on it was the Auditorium and Masonic Temple, and of course all were full houses immediately, there was an old box office guy at the Studebaker Theater, name of Nat. He says, "I can't figure this thing out. Who is this guy? He packs them all in here. I've been in show business 55 years. I handle Milton Berle, Gypsy Rose Lee, Hell's a Poppin', Olson and Johnson, Hell's a Poppin', even Billy Graham. But I've seen nothing like this." He said, "No, what's it about? What is it? Is it an extension of the National Bar Dance?" I said, no, it's something called Prairie. See, the man tells stories. And, of course, that's what it was about. That's what it's all about. We know one of the most gifted storytellers of our time is Garrison Keillor. Of course, it's in the tradition of Mark Twain, of Ring Lardner. Storytelling, the core of all literature. And who better than Garrison Keillor in telling that? At a time when high tech has never been so high, and the expansion, the thought span so low, here is a man telling a story, and what is, I think, the real silent majority, a phrase perverted a generation ago, the real of the people seeking something not quite expressed elsewhere in quote-unquote show business and in politics, is expressed so giftedly and beautifully by Garrison Keillor. And that's why you're here tonight. And that's why he's the phenomenon he is, whether it be his pieces in The New Yorker or his books. And you know, the Book of Guys is out there for you to get later on inscribed. And with him is a gifted poet, Roland Flint, now teaching at Georgetown, but a Midwesterner. And you'll hear both gifted men. And here then, Garrison Keillor.
Thank you, Studs. Studs loves to come and introduce people at these events so that he and his wife Ida can sit for free in the and get good seats. But even though that's his motive, he still puts his heart into it. And I appreciate that. It's an honor to be introduced by Studs, and great pleasure to meet him whenever I get a chance to. Can you all hear back here? What can we do about you? I'm a little worried about you sitting back in the corner. Is it going to help if I pull this lectern back? Am I going to cause pain and consternation to a lot of people? I feel as if I pull it back, a disaster will occur. And someone up there is nodding yes. Yes. All right. Can you hear all right to my right side back there? Do you mind looking at this angle of my head? Okay. All right. And over here on this side over here, is that all right?
Okay. All right. I appreciate that.
It's an honor to come and to read with Roland Flint tonight, a poet whom 30 years ago, as a student editor at the University of Minnesota, I received this poem by Roland Flint in the intercampus mail at the University of Minnesota. He was an instructor in the English department. His office was one building away from the office of the magazine that I edited. And I opened my envelope and I read this poem, which is 30-some years old, entitled August from My Desk. It is hot today, dry enough for cutting grain, and I am drifting back to North Dakota, where butterflies are all gone brown with wheat dust, and where some boy, red-faced, sweating, chafed, too young to be dying this way, steers a laborious, self-propelled combine, dreaming of cities and blizzards and airplanes. With the white silk scarf of his sleeve, he shines and shines his goggles. He checks his meters, checks his flaps, screams contact at his dreamless father. He pulls back the stick, engines roaring, and hurtles into the sun. I published that poem, and then a few months later met Roland Flint and talked to him on the telephone, and he was a little apologetic. He asked me if it would be all right with me, though I had printed it first in the University magazine, if the Atlantic Monthly also printed it. I was 21 years old. I said, sure. It's all right. That's the sort of poem that I wanted to write when I was 21 years old, and seeing that I could not, I took a different course in life, which I will always regret. But my beginnings in poetry were not as honorable. I started out performing poems. I was a student at Anoka High School, and I was drafted to recite a poem at the high school talent show. It was a poem that I had recited for my teacher, Miss Rasmussen, in class by Walt Whitman, his elegy to Abraham Lincoln, "O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won," and so on. When I recited this in class, my friends who sat down in the front row, their reaction to poetry was that of most people. They rolled their eyes. They made gagging and retching sounds. And they pulled long, invisible strings of snot out of their noses. But my teacher was impressed because it was Whitman and because I knew it by heart. And so she assigned me to recite this in front of the entire school, which to me was like a sentence of death, thinking of 1,000 people making retching and gagging sounds. And so I came up with the great stratagem of reciting it in the accent of the English actors whose recordings my English teacher loved to play for us, reciting English verse, actors like Sir John Gielgud, who spoke in kind of blah, 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 high bird-like tones, and actors with sort of deep, jowly voices.
who talked as one might expect golden retrievers would talk. And so I recited for the school,
"Oh, Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has rolled every rack. The prize we sought is won. But oh, the bleeding drops of red. Well, on the deck my Captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead." So you see,
I didn't even get into poetry using my own voice. I was a fraud from the very beginning, and I've continued to be one, but I have enjoyed it. I wrote one poem about Chicago, not about Chicago, but set in Chicago, that I wanted to be sure and recite. It's, I think, a very honest poem, whether or not it's historically accurate or not. It's honest beyond that. It's entitled Mrs. Sullivan. "Function follows form," said Louis Sullivan one warm evening in Chicago, drinking beer. His wife said, "Dear, I'm sure that what you meant is that form should represent function, so it's function that should be followed." Louis Sullivan swallowed and looked far away. "Okay," he said. "Form follows function, then." He said it again. A three-word spark of modern architectural brilliance that would dazzle millions. "Think I should write it down?" he asked with a frown. "Oh, yes," she said. "And here's a pencil." He did, and soon was influential. I would like to dedicate that poem to Mrs. Studs Terkel here. "Dogs don't lie, and why should I? When strangers come, they growl and bark. They know their loved ones in the dark. Now let me, by night or day, be just as filled with truth as they. My parents think I'm crazy. My kids think I'm bourgeois. My true love thinks I'm wonderful, the handsomest she ever saw. And who am I to disagree with one so sensible as she?" My father memorized poems. He knew great swatches of Longfellow and even bits of Tennyson by heart. He knew a great deal of The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, and he knew Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree the Village Smithy Stands. Poems are easier to memorize and hold in your mind if they are rhymed and are metrical, though it's not impossible to remember others, as you'll see tonight. But I always loved walking around with at least a few poems and some fresh ones in my mind. Starting back in high school when we memorized Shakespearean sonnets in English class. I, of course, wanted to memorize "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds," a poem that you could imagine might be useful to you someday, sitting in a dark place with one whom you love and who is not sure she loves you. But that poem was taken already. It had been claimed by
a young woman who I doubted ever would have use for it in her life. And instead, I had to memorize, "When in disgrace with fortune in men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and think upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy, content at least. Yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings that I would scorn to change my lot with kings." I memorized poems for romantic intensity. When I was 22 years old, the poem by Houseman seemed a poem that one had to memorize so that one could walk around late at night in the spring and think of the poem over and over. "Loveliest of trees, the cherry now, is hung with bloom along the bough. It stands along the woodland ride, wearing white for Eastertide." Now of my 80 years and 10, 20 will not come again. Subtract from 70 springs a score, it only leaves me 50 more. And since to look at things in bloom, 50 springs is little room, along the woodland I will go to watch the cherry hung with snow. I never wrote poems as great as those. The poems that I wrote tended to be more along the lines of, "Oh, what a luxury it be, what pleasure, oh, what perfect bliss, how ordinary and yet chic, to pee, to piss, to take a leak. To feel your bladder just go free and open like the mighty miss, and all your cares go down that creek, to pee, to piss, to take a leak. For gentlemen of great physique who can hold water for 1 week, for ladies who 1/4 cup of tea can fill completely up, for folks in urinalysis, for little kids just learning this, for Viennese or Swiss or Greek, for anyone, it's pretty great to urinate. Women are quite circumspect, but men can piss with great effect, with terrible hydraulic force can make a stream or change its course, can put out fires or cigarettes, and sometimes laying down our bets late at night outside the bars, we'd like to aim up at the stars. Oh yes, for men it's much more grand. Women sit or squat, we stand and hold the fellow in our hand and proudly watch the mighty arc, adjust the range and make our mark on stones and posts for rival men to smell and not come back again. I want to read one more of Roland's poems, because I'm afraid he won't, and bring him up to give you a few of his. This poem dates from, I believe, about the same time. I remember seeing this at the same time as I accepted for publication August from my desk, but I believe this had been published elsewhere. It's a beautiful poem, and it's amazing to read it now 30 years later and to have it be so alive. She was 8. Patsy Murphy had red knuckles from marble games and went coatless in winter early and late. When she died, we went to see her in her inevitable pink coffin and tried to think of missing her. I envied the Catholics, busy with their hands. She was 8. Now is a time of crippled sounds through the soft air, of doves making summer grief, of leghorns flapping anger at the sky. Here on the prairie, our dream of ocean, we can see the sun all day and watch the moon stand up, flowers open, flowers close. No flower, nothing delicate, implicit in her features, all too large, was beauty. Her grudging, fudging marble skill said woman, strong. In reluctant prairie trees outside, the grass makes small obeisance to a stream that is reaching for the sea, leaves cartwheeling on its back, while minutely speckled minnows sweep silently and swift as gulls. My face is growing smaller. Patricia, my classmate, has been dead for 20 years. It's an honor to be here tonight with Mr. Roland Flint.
A friend of mine is a Southerner, asked me what I was going to Chicago for, and I said I was going to read with Garrison Keillor. He said, "I hope you're going on first." I said, "No, I'm actually following him." He said, "A suicidal impulse, you understand?" I'm very happy to be here, honored to be here with my old friend Garrison and to have him read these old poems. And honored to be introduced by Studs Terkel. I'm going to read some poems, and Garrison's coming back, and we're going to go back and forth in such fashion. And the first poem I'm going to read is called First Poem. When I was 8 or 9, Mr. Bina showed me how to saw a six-shooter out of plywood, which I did. And when he looked it over, he said it was fine. One morning it was gone, and when my siblings were cleared, Mother said, "Honey, someone kindled the heater with it." But he didn't understand. In his Saturday woodcraft classes during the war, to Tall John Bina, we were equally poets, who taught us to make ducks, guns, or dowels out of wood. His high, Czech face smiled seriously when he explained, "If I'm too old already for the war, I can still teach you about the woods and saws." Mm-hmm, that's good. No, it wasn't a poem. I'm not sure it was a pistol, but something I believed was good. The war and woodwork classes ended when I was 10. Then Claire Clemetson and Bobby Erickson came home from the Pacific at last, but many from Park River like John Kellner and Jimmy Caldwell didn't. Jimmy's parents still came to the Lyric Theater, sat halfway back holding hands, and you could hear Ed's handsome laugh sometimes. Not the Kellners. John had been tough enough to survive the Bataan Death March, but then something killed him and killed their joy. I didn't know the Binas as a couple, Blanche and John, except in working the garden between our houses or in old country pleasure of their daughters. 45 years later, all five, Irene, Lorraine, Dorothy, Catherine, and Joanne, were back in town and harmonized, full-voiced impromptu singing at Irene's. When they got ready to sing in Czech, the second youngest, Catherine, nicknamed Mickey, said, "Oh, I'll cry. I'm crying already." And they laughed. The daughters of Blanche and John stood singing their parents back to us, like poets, no one needing to solo or shine, as the best ones rarely do, and it was good. I want to read now a poem called Are You in Town Too? Garrison and I both come from a part of the country where people say that. Oh, are you in town today too? Grandma Rose saved quarters in the cylindrical glass tubes. Do you remember the old Alka-Seltzer? In the cylindrical glass tubes from which she had removed tablets for indigestion. I guess she saved them to give us, or to buy the gifts with which she came. Maybe emptying and filling them so relieved her fatal stomach for a while. Though they had irresistible heft, the quarters banked like that. I forget if I took any, but she was trusting, and I did steal Indian head pennies from my mother's collection, 15 at a time, for chocolate half-pint sundaes at the luxury ice cream store and creamery, where that Norwegian farmer asked another, "Are you in town today too, then?" "No," said the other. "I just come in with the cream." As if to be in town, you had to be in town to be there. Rather like being at home at a certain time or receiving a sense of occasion, as had Grandmother Rose whenever she came to us, the visiting grandmother come to give us gifts, to be neatly dressed in black, her big purse smelling inside of lilac, Alka-Seltzer, the leathery cloth and glass, and the silver warm smell of quarters. I'm going to read a longer poem now. Not very long, because I don't write any that are very long. I was at a reading once where someone took up far too much of his share of the time. In fact, I wrote a little poem about that happening. After reading for 35 minutes, when you ask him to read for 15, because he is sharing the time with two other poets, he says, "Now for some longer pieces." I'm going to read this, and I apologize ahead of time. You'll see why. It makes certain kinds of demands, and I usually don't read it. Garrison encouraged me to, and thought that this is the audience, might be the audience to receive it. It's called Stubborn. On a rainy Sunday, I have an optional meeting with my students, and 11 show up. We have a good time talking 90 minutes or so about James Wright's To a Blossoming Pear Tree. Afterwards, though I had thought to stay in my office, I decide to go home, because I'm too agitated to work, having drunk a large cup of strong coffee instead of my usual decaffeinated stuff. I call Rosalind to tell her I'm coming home, and she seems glad, but, as she had earlier this morning, also a bit depressed. Why? She thinks it's because, although she's happy to be going back to New Zealand tomorrow, she's sad about leaving her sons and me at Christmas. So I decide to get her some flowers on the way home. I buy a bunch each of blue and white irises and three yellow sweetheart roses. At the busy florist, there is a woman of 27 or 28 wearing a sweatshirt with my school's name on it. I don't know her, but she glances as if she recognizes me. She has thick blonde hair with some soft reds in it, and I think it is not so red or fine as my son's hair was. I also think she looks some like the daisies she's picking out. And I think to put in a poem sometime, a woman's hair with the colors of a daisy's eye. Driving home, I come aware how beautifully iris folds in and out upon itself, like someone in grief, like my mother in hers, her long, sad life, which ended 77 days ago. It occurs to me, though I had told the clerk no ferns, because they remind me of funeral sprays, that when she absently asked me again if I wanted ferns, I said yes, as absently, which makes me realize how much my mother is on my mind, buried on the 11th anniversary of the boy's death. Also, not quite refusing it but resisting it, I can't keep out the solace he is with her now. And even as I'm annoyed to suppose I'll put this too in a poem sometime, I think of the boy's mother, of my mother, my wife, these women in their sorrows, and consider some failures touching all of them, the irises and roses beside me on the seat. On Nebraska Avenue, I see a very small boy walking on the grass between the sidewalk and the street, alone except for a big golden retriever near him. I can't tell if they are together. When it comes to me, the boy really is alone, so near the street and only 2 years old or younger. My stomach moves with fear. I pull over, stop the car, get out and ask a jogger who is slowing to a walk if he knows the boy. No, he doesn't. I try to be calm and talk quietly to the boy. Where do you live? Where is your house? He doesn't answer. The car's blowing by, but seems to wave toward the dog. I say, let's go there, and try to smile him into walking along with me, aware the jogger has stopped and, as I would do, is wondering about me and what I might be up to. I don't try to take the boy's hand. Mine, I see, is trembling. He doesn't speak. He may not be old enough to speak. Then I hear someone scared and calling. We're next to a steeply banked yard behind a wall, chest high. I see the parents running down and hear them calling a name. I pick the boy up under his arm slowly as I can and hold him up so they can see him. He does not cry out. The mother is nodding yes and waves relief. They are not coming from the direction I was trying to get the boy to go. I put him down, and now he takes my hand as we walk back around the corner toward his parents. When he sees his father, he pulls away and, making wordless noises, runs to him back onto the grass next to the curb. The father is so angry with himself, he begins yelling, Michael, where did you go? And I say too loudly, hearing how my voice is shaking, I think he's very frightened now, hoping he will stop yelling at his son, and he does stop. Michael wants his father to come with him back to the corner where he points at the dog. Ah, says the father, and calls to him, Benny. Benny comes running. Michael had been following Benny. We talk. They thank me. They had just now noticed Michael somehow got out in the rain. As the guilty father talks me back to my car, I answer carefully, trying to hold my voice down. I tell him I understand that my oldest daughter somehow got out when she was 18 months and almost got into the street, how a neighbor took her in and called me. I understand. I don't want to say more, and I'm afraid I'll start crying, but I have to make it clearer, to warn him. I tell him, my son was killed in the street like this. He says, really? And thanks me again, and I leave. I don't start crying until I get back in the car, and I'm furious and grown with it to know even then, in spite of myself, that I'll write about this as well, pulled through the pages by something as if in the hand, to write it down here. Besides despair of writing it well enough, is this revulsion at smearing grief in order to do it? To use a poem as if you were trading what you have lived through for words, selling out by using the worst secrets. But the words come anyway. So when finally I have to write them down, I fear I may be stupidly tempting death. And yet I write them as if my life is the poem to give. Its work come clearly saying, go and write do what has been given to do, and if it is given in grief, accept it there, where you may see whatever else is given. This time Michael, following Benny in the rain, has made you feel in his small hand bones the unknown body of his living, his unrepeatable life, which you write down as if it were your own. As if this prayer, Michael might have his life, is something mending your own. And maybe it is. Well, I won't do that to you again. I want to say a poem by a wonderful poet who lived for a while in Chicago and worked on Poetry Magazine, Isabella Stewart Gardner. Worked here on Poetry Magazine with Carl Shapiro. And she has a poem I'd like to say called Letter from Slough Pond. I know she pronounced it that way. I'm from North Dakota, and we'd say Slough. I wonder if you still do in Chicago. I wonder where it turns crossing the country. And people began to say Slough. It's on the Cape, and it's a woman who's vacationing alone. Apparently her husband has driven her there. Maybe things aren't going as well as they should. And it refers to the sea, because they're on that Cape, so there are lots of fresh ponds and the ocean is nearby. And this is what she says in her letter. Here where you left me alone, the soft wind sighs through my wishbone. The sun is lapping at my flesh. I couple with the ripples of the fresh pond water. I am roiled by the rolling sea. Love, in our wide bed, do you lie lonely? The spoon of longing stirs my marrow, and I thank God this bed is narrow. I'm going to read two more and turn back to Garrison. This is called Still, as in cabin still, as in distillery, as in whiskey. And there are some quotations in it. I wrote it after reading this article in a Lynchburg, Virginia newspaper. There are some quotations, and when there are, I will just signal like that, so I'm not charged with plagiarism. we get poems from every place, don't we? It occurs to me that when I was driving there on Highway 29 in Virginia, I stopped at my favorite truck stop outside Warrenton. Is it Warrenton? Quarles Truck Stop, wonderful homemade food loaded with cholesterol and sugar. And there's a big men's room there, because there are showers. The truckers stop there and change clothes. In the men's room, there was a whole bank of condoms and a whole section in that bank of pastel condoms. And some Virginia poet of the highways had written in grease pencil across it, "Don't buy this gum, it tastes like rubber." Well, here's my poem called Still, that comes from the Lynchburg paper. Today's paper carries this headline: Fading taste for bourbon pinches Kentucky. But a distiller named Bill Samuels Jr. is not concerned, saying the market has always had its highs and lows, and besides, he says, though his is a small company with sales of only 125,000 cases a year, he's doing fine. We sell out of whiskey every year, and you can hardly beat that when everybody's wringing their hands. His own brand is Maker's Mark. His family has made whiskey for four generations near Bardstown, Kentucky, and he tells the family story. How an ancestor was mustered out of the Revolutionary War in 1793, moved to Kentucky, and turned to whiskey. Land was offered to anyone who would settle, raise corn, and stay 3 years. This, says Samuels, was most attractive to people who knew what to do with corn. They started making whiskey, and that was the first money of the West. This story in the Lynchburg News soaks in a high mash flavor, which just hints that if our taste is fading, it's because our tongues and palates have been bleached by Pacific Chablis, dulled by low-cal reds, and washed out by Bad Light beer. While Pinch's Kentucky gauges a slack in the belly of the country's swagger as still hands are laid off, and the recession, more than taste, trickles dry down the mean alembics of the time. Next, the expert American of Mr. Samuels, whose border drawl is 200 years into the hickory tough grain of his saying, "We sell out of whiskey," and whose work has had no trouble paying off his father's, his, and his son's bills, and so he understands the problem to be one of quality control, or as we used to say, know-how. If all these poor hand-wringing sons of whiskey makers only knew what to do with that corn. An oak-aged, 100-proof canticle of knowing what to do with the hands. And what about Bardstown? Was this whiskey town named for a poet? Or all poets? I doubt it. Probably for some John or Henry or Bill Bard. But this American Samuels and Samuel's son has made his name with Maker's Mark, a bourbon bearing the poet's verb, poyain, to make. As if, from the secret empty spaces in that seed kernel of corn planted in a dark and bloody ground by revolutionary regulars, we make not only the feed to tame wild turkeys and the first hard coin of our brusquely scalawagging West, but refine as well from the corn's raw dream, a forked white lightning, home-brewed, or the straight and sour mash lyric of our genius, that ever clear, or red jagging water, river branch and grain, we drink our history in. Now, I've got one related to it. When I wrote the first draft of that, I did something I hadn't done for a long time. I took it and imposed it on. I was at an artist colony and I heard people in the next studio talking, so I went and asked to read it to them. And I got another poem from it. It's called Gift. Now here is a poem for Nancy, who along with Mark, let me read her my brand new bourbon whiskey poem. Not only because she let me and agreed to my rules beforehand, that they must like it, say so, and mean it. And not only because when I read it, she liked it and meant it, but also, and overridingly, may the mystery bless her because she said, wait, first I'm going to lie down. We were in Mark's studio and she lay down on the couch, closing her eyes, the better to welcome my whiskey poem. Without ever knowing it, all my obscure scribbler's life, I have wanted to write one poem, a woman beautiful as Nancy would want like that to lie down for. I thank her for revealing this, for liking my poem about whiskey, and for meaning it, but most for lying down. When I go to the writer's last place, I will say, I am Flint. I wrote one poem, Nancy the Muse, lay down for.
I used to have two cats who were named whimsical names, as most cats were back then in the mid-1970s, but not as whimsical as a lot of other cats in our neighborhood there in St. Paul, cats named Meow Tsutung and F. Cat Fitzgerald and... We named our cats Tuna and Ralph, and they were a great pair. They were both males, neutered males, but Tuna was much more female in her female cat-like in her disposition, and Ralph was the was the lonely hunter. He disappeared once for 2.5 months, just after we'd become attached to him. And 2.5 months was long enough to begin writing this poem, which then I was able to finish off when Ralph returned. He did not seem to have lost weight on his return. In fact, he'd seemed to gain quite a bit. He'd gone and lived with somebody, and then, for some reason, had remembered us. Perhaps because he knew that I was a writer and I would write about him. My cat, he pleaded, and my cat, he cried for me to open up the door and let him go outside. Then he sat on the lawn underneath a tree, pretending that he couldn't hear me as I said, "Cat, you better come on home. There's dogs in the dark waiting to attack, and cat hawks looking for a late night snack. So, cat, you better come home." My cat, he turned and tossed his head. "I may or may not come," he said. "I'm a cat who's deeply dissatisfied. I'll let you know when I decide." I said, "Cat, you better come on home. I'll close this door and lock this bolt. You can spend the night in the snow and the cold. So, cat, you better shag it on in here." He said, "I'd rather be a cat that meets a terrible fate than live with a man who don't appreciate that a cat is independent and a true highbrow and demands a little high-class chow. I've seen the food that you feed your guests, the turkey and the tuna and the chicken breasts, and do you share it with your cat? No, you don't, no way, not the poached perch liver pate." And I said, "Cat, you better come on home. I'm not about to stand here and argue with a cat. Now, what would the next door neighbors think of that? So, cat, you better come home." "Well, I never," he said, and he turned in a huff. "You've seen the last of your old cat, Puff. He left with a huh and a sardonic laugh, and he left for 3.5 months. I felt so bad, full of guilt and shame. I walked around town just calling in his name with a great big plate of Chateaubriand and some tuna fish in my hand. And I said, 'Cat, I wish you'd come back home. Come on, old cat, come home with us. I got a lot of fringe benefits I'd like to discuss. So, cat, won't you please come home?'" I saw him 6 months later in a cat magazine. He was the number one TV cat food queen with a fat contract with a cat food firm, and his hair was done up in a perm. He was lying on a beach in the south of Greece, and he changed his name to Maurice. I said, "Cat, you better come home. You're riding high. You're riding high, but to dump you in the river when the well runs dry. So, cat, you better come home." Sure enough, he came back one day last fall. He was on his last legs. He could barely crawl, with his great big tail dragging on the ground because he weighed about 89 pounds. He looked like something that the cat dragged in, with his tongue hanging out on his double chin and great big bags underneath his eyes. He said, "It's me, surprise." I picked him up like a big fur sack. He said, "Easy, Jack, I got a salmon on my back. I got a big salmon habit, and that's no lie. I got to go cold turkey on the tuna fish pie." If other cats could only know to hang their hats on the status quo, because the very worst thing that a cat can do is to make all its dreams come true. So, cats, you better go home. There's dogs in the dark waiting to attack, and cat hawks looking for a late night snack. And cats, you better go home. This is a poem for this time of year. When I started out with a Prairie Home Companion, we toured a great deal in a motor home. We traveled around Minnesota and North Dakota, South Dakota, and parts of Wisconsin, northern Iowa. We'd go out for 3 weeks in the spring and for 3 weeks in the fall. We traveled around in this motorhome and we camped in tents. One of our tours out to western Minnesota later became known among the musicians who played in the Powder Milk Biscuit Band as the Death March to the Prairie. We were snowbound once in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and had to stay with some very kind Lutherans. But we had to stay longer than we really wanted to spend with them. And I learned more about Lutherans than I wanted to know. And we went up to the Iron Range and fell in with a Finnish band up there near Eveleth, Minnesota. Our fall tour was late this year, and we were touring, I believe, in early December because there was some ice on the lakes, and the Finnish band took us in hand and took us out to their cabin, and we had our first real saunas, where you sit in the house and then naked walk down the slope of snow and out on the ice to where there's a hole in about 4 feet of water, and you jump in and you hear such a cry come out of your own mouth that just it's the beginning of the Finnish language, I believe. I wrote a poem in their honor, called The Finn Who Would Not Take a Sauna. The man and the woman are remembered in this poem. His name really was Toivo, and she really was rather large. In northeast Minnesota, what they call the Iron Range, where men are men and women aren't and some things never change, where winter stays 9 months a year, there is no spring or fall, and it's so cold the mercury cannot be seen at all, where you and I, we normal folks, would shiver, shake, and chatter, and if we used an outhouse, we might grow a larger bladder. But even when it's coldest, when our hands would have no feeling, those Iron Rangers get dressed up and go out snowmobiling out across the frozen waste and make a couple stops at Rudy's Bar and Gino's Lounge for whiskey, beer, and schnapps. Then they go into a little shack that's filled with boiling rocks, hot enough to sterilize an Iron Ranger's socks. They sit there till they steam out every sin and every foible. Then they jump into a frozen lake and claim that it's enjoyable. But there was one, a shy young man, and although he was Finnish, the joys of winter had for him long started to diminish. He was a Finn, the only Finn, who would not take a sauna. It isn't that I can't, he said, I simply do not wanna. To jump into a frozen lake is not my fondest wish, for just because I am a Finn don't mean that I'm a fish. His friend said, come on, Toivo, let's go down to Sunfish Lake. A Finn who don't take saunas, why, there must be some mistake. But Toivo said, there's no mistake. I know that I would freeze in water colder than myself, 98.6 degrees. And so he stayed close by a stove for 9 months of the year because he was so sensitive to change of temperature. One night he went to Eveleth to attend the miners' ball. If you've never danced in Eveleth, you've never danced at all. He met a Finnish beauty there who turned his head around. She was broad of beam, and when she danced, she shook the frozen ground. She took that shy young man in hand and swept him off his feet and bounced him up and down till he learned the polka beat. And when the dance was over, she was as tall as she was fair as she was wide. And when the dance was over, he asked her to be his bride. She looked him over carefully. She said, you're kind of thin, but you must have some courage if it's true you are a Finn. I'm not particular about men. I am no prima donna. But I would never marry one who would not take a sauna.
They got into her pickup, and down the road they drove, and 15 minutes later they were stoking up the stove. She had a flask of whiskey, a flisk of whiskey, she had some of that Maker's Mark. And they had a couple toots and went into the shack and got into their birthday suits. She steamed him and she boiled him until his skin was red. She poured it on until his brains were bubbling in his head. To improve his disposition and to soften up his hide, she took a couple birch boughs and she beat him till he cried. Oh, couldn't you just love me now? Oh, don't you think you can? She said, it's time to go outside and show you are a man. Straightway, because he loved her so, he thought his heart would break. He jumped right up and out the door and ran down to the lake. And though he paused a moment when he saw the lake was frozen and tried to think just which snowbank his love had put his clothes in, when he thought of Tina, he did not think twice. He just picked up his size 13s and raced across the ice, and coming to the hole that they had cut there with an axe, putting common sense aside, ignoring all the facts, he leaped, oh what a leap, and as he dove beneath the surface, it thrilled him to his very soul and also made him nervous. And it wasn't just the tingling that he felt in every limb. He cried, my love, I'm finished, I forgot, I cannot swim. She fished him out and stood him up and gave him an embrace that made the blood rush to his feet, his fingers, and his face. I love you, darling dear, she cried. I love you with all my might. And she drove him to Bewabik, and he married her that night. They found a little farm up near Hibbing, west of Chisholm, and settled down to a life of love and Lutheranism. And they are married to this day, although they sometimes quarrel. And there, I guess, my story ends, except for this, the moral. Love, my friends, is a lifelong banquet. Love is no light lunch. We cannot dabble round the edge, but each must take the plunge. And though marriage, like that frozen lake, may sometimes make us colder, it has its pleasures too, as you may find out when you're older.